Good afternoon, listeners. This is the RightStream Radio Network, and this show is Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and we are broadcasting live from beautiful Fairfax, Virginia, where it is just about the nicest fall day in the world outside. This is why I love this area. I grew up in Southern California originally and on the beaches there. And people ask, well, why in the world would you move back here? And I said, believe it or not, we like the seasons. I like the green and I like the seasons. Today we're going to have a very special guest. In our business, there are a handful of people who seem to go and have universal respect when they speak to the subject for which they are an expert. And this lady is certainly one of those people. Professor Christine Fair is a professor at Georgetown University. She is part of the security studies program there and has made her specialty the study of South Asia, its politics, its societies, its militaries, and its interactions. And she has gone and become one of the acknowledged experts on the region, its history, and how it works, which is very different from how our country works or doesn't work, and at the same time views itself through very different lenses from what the rest of the world sees it. This particular program is going to be all about the country of Pakistan, which if you have been watching over the past 50 or 75 years, has been one of South Asia's greatest international challenges. Born of the 1947 partition with India, it has become a nuclear power. It has a huge military. It has been our ally at times, if you believe some people. It has been our frenemy at times, like now. And we're going to talk to someone who has just written a great new book, and that is Christine Fair. And hang on here, let's push the button. And let's see here, come on. I love technology. Christine, are you with us?
I am indeed. Thank you.
Thank you for appearing with us today, and we're going to talk about a new book you've just released through Oxford University Press called Fight Into the End, and it is about the Pakistani Army. Now, we're going to talk a lot about the Pakistani Army, but I'd like to start talking a little bit about you. What? And I don't mean to make this sound like a bar line, but what's a pretty lady like you studying a place like that for?
Oh, dude, I dated a lot of waiters in college. That's the only suitable response, right? So actually, you know, I started my current career. I did have a previous career actually in the sciences, which is actually what first brought me into contact with South Asia, was working with my colleagues in the lab. But I actually began as a general South Asianist, doing what all South Asianists do, which is you go to India, you study Hindi, and then you switch over to Urdu, and then try to go to Pakistan if you're interested. And, of course, I was interested. And then I ended up at the RAND Corporation for a variety of reasons. I finished my PhD while working full-time. And my first real project working on South Asia happened in 1998 after the reciprocal Indian and Pakistani nuclear test took place. And then that quickly was followed up by a project on the 1999 Cargill War, and I had the opportunity of studying and working with and being mentored by the indomitable Ashley Tellus. And then, quite frankly, after 9/11, my life basically became hijacked, and I went from being a South Asianist to being someone who worked almost exclusively on Pakistan security-related projects. And the reason for that was I was one of the few people at the time who had a clearance, who knew Pakistan pretty well, and actually who knew Urdu. So I would have to say that had 9/11 not happened, I would probably be like all of the other South Asianists who were happily working away on India-related issues. But because I had this unique training in Pakistan at a unique time, I became foisted up as this Pakistan expert.
Sorry to tell you, but you're our go-to gal when it comes to Pakistan, and for that matter, the whole region. And today, of course, you teach and work at Georgetown University. Talk a little bit about what you're doing there.
So, yeah, I was very fortunate. I mean, I think I became very dismayed with the entire think tank business model after 9/11. I loved working at RAND prior to 9/11. I was very proud of the work that we did. It was marked by empiricism, rigor. Every once in a while, the client would try to suppress findings, but we did not alter the findings to make the client happy. If the client exercised its contractual right to suppress findings until the political environment was more suitable for the findings, there was very little that RAND could do except exercise its reciprocal contractual right to make the findings published. And so this would always be negotiated between the organization and the client. After 9/11, the pressure really was to tell the client what they wanted to know, not what they needed to know. And I felt not happy with the kind of work that I was doing at the RAND Corporation. And as you may or may not know, I am at cold war with RAND. Every time they publish something stupid, which is often, I decimate it. And at one point, the vice president, one of their vice presidents actually called me up to ask me what it would take to get me to stop tearing apart their products. And I said, well, you know, spend more time with quality assurance onto my Twitter feed would be my short response. And so I was very, very lucky because someone with my trajectory ordinarily would not have a place in academia. Academia tends to be very wary of people who have done work in the real world. They tend to be especially wary of anyone that's had contacts with the intelligence organizations and so forth. But Georgetown actually gave me a crack, and I'm very, very grateful for that because I wouldn't be able to do the kind of work that I have been able to do in any other environment if for no other reason because of autonomy. And, of course, in a place like RAND, you'd have to find a client to pay for this stuff, and running it through the RAND business model would be prohibitively costly, whereas at a university, your fixed costs, namely your salary and your benefits, is already paid, right, because your primary job is teaching. So since joining Georgetown, I've had a lot of really fun projects. I do a lot of survey work amongst Pakistanis with my colleagues Jacob Shapiro and Neil Malhotra. We've been pioneering an experimental form of survey work so that we can ask sensitive questions like popular support for terrorist groups while minimizing risk to both the interviewer as well as the subject. I have another project that I've been working on, which is on militant markets in Pakistan. So I really dislike this radicalization, de-radicalization discourse. My brothers, when they joined the U.S. Army at the age of 16, no one ever said the U.S. Army radicalized my brothers. And they were de-radicalized when they will hit their 20-year service mark and retire. And yet I find that when I look at militant groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, for example, this radicalization discourse is completely unhelpful. What they're really doing is they're manning a mission. They are more like an elite special operator force than they are anything else. And so in my approach to militant recruitment in Pakistan, I don't think of this as a radicalization / de-radicalization puzzle. I see it as these organizations are manning a mission, and they're going to find the right person for that mission subject to quality, cost, time, bureaucratic, and other sorts of constraints. So that's a book that I'm working on that's under contract with Columbia University Press. And then the book I'm working on right now is with a co-author named Mustafa Samdani. And we've collected about 10 or so of Lashkar-e-Taiba's major works. And the book is called Lashkar-e-Taiba in Their Own Words. And it's basically a book that presents insights from the organization, how they recruit, how they operate, who they recruit, why they do what they do, who's the enemy, what makes an enemy, under what conditions does one become an enemy, and so forth, basically from their own publication. So it'll be a textual analysis, a similar methodology, actually, to what I have here in the Pakistan Army book.
Now, you also have several other things you do. You've been known to occasionally work for the United Nations and monitor elections. You were telling me some great stories yesterday about adventures in monitoring Pakistani elections. You also go and teach young minds, and we have a number of mutual friends who you have had you as a teacher and still talk about you with glowing admiration for your style and your work. Talk a little bit about the election monitoring and what sort of pratfalls can you get into there?
Well, I've become very problematic with respect to Pakistan. I've done election monitoring in Bangladesh, twice in Pakistan, and twice in Afghanistan. In election monitoring, you know, at some level, you're not really certifying that the election is free of duplicity or fraud or vote engineering. But because, you know, in essence, in these places, your ability to see what's going on varies deeply, and especially if you don't have language skills. So I do have language skills in Pakistan. My Dari is unfortunately not where I wish it were, even though I did study in Iran in 2001. It's a use it or lose it thing. But I don't know any Bengali. So in some sense, these election monitoring gigs, you can see structural issues. Like, for example, you can look at the rules that the different election commissions devise for candidates being allowed to contest an election, what sort of problems exist with the voter registration list. You can observe how the different polling stations in different areas are observing the electoral rules. Like, for example, one of the things I saw in Bangladesh, which was great, was, for many Muslim countries, there's this whole question of hijab. And this is why they have male and female polling stations. So in principle, a female should be able to ask you to, and especially with niqab, where your face is fully covered, they should be able to ask you to pull up your veil to make sure that you are that person voting. And at one of these polling booths, they were not. This was in Comilla, which is a strong Jamaat Islami stronghold in Bangladesh. These women were, first of all, I wasn't sure they were really women. they didn't have the characteristic build, and they weren't ever asked to show their faces. And so when you see these kinds of things, it obviously raises all kinds of questions about who are these voters? I mean, are they really who they say they are? Election monitoring is always fun. In the 2008 election, I was an observer actually in Peshawar, and that was fabulous because, again, you see things that can go wrong if you're lucky. Usually you never run into things because what's the chance? Everyone knows where the election observers are going, particularly in a place like Pakistan because of security. You're not really randomly going. It's a combination of where can you go versus where the state will let you go, and then there's always the on-the-ground calls of your security officer. But I went to this one, and female polling stations, by the way, are notorious because very few women relative to men register. So it's a great opportunity to stuff the registration rolls with, like, fake women. And then this is also an opportunity to stuff the ballot boxes. So usually when things go to hell in a handbasket, it usually involves female polling stations. So I go to this one female polling station, and our security guards, we had these South African guys that provided outer security, but the people that provided inner security were these Pakistani guards. And so I went into this one polling station, and immediately it was clear that some stuff was really going down. The female polling agent was saying, well, actually, our polling booth has been captured because one of the candidates is angry that his female voters aren't being allowed to vote. And I was like, well, you know, what should you do about this? Who do you call? Because no one was being allowed to vote. So when they talk about a polling booth being captured, it means that some hooligans or thugs are preventing women from voting or preventing people from voting. So within moments, my security guard comes in and he says, madam, out. And so, and when he says, madam, out, he's not asking. He says, madam, get your butt in gear, get out. And so we get back into the car, and as we're going, the polling station was a little bit on a hill, and the road was sort of winding down the hill. As we were winding down the hill, a whole slew of dudes with guns and Hiluxes were careening up the hill. So that was obviously going to be very, very interesting later that day. And then also later that night, typically when you do these observation missions, you'll open up a polling station. You'll make sure that they're observing all the correct practices. And then you'll go back to the same polling station that you opened to make sure that they're closing down appropriately. And so we go back to the same polling station that we opened. And immediately there was a ruckus about invalidating ballots. You don't have hanging chad in Pakistan, but the way, I mean, they, you invalidate ballots for different reasons because the ballots are really simple. But sure enough, my security guard comes in and he says, madam, out. So that was a phrase I heard quite a bit that day in Peshawar, madam, out.
Now, we're going to be talking today about Pakistan, and this is in the context of the fact that you've just published a brand new book on the Pakistani army called Fighting to the End. And just so that our listeners can understand, this has not made you very popular within Pakistan and with the Pakistani army. And in fact, you've made a few enemies, haven't you?
Well, so my problem with these guys began in 2011. They got from a colleague of mine who shall remain nameless, mostly because I'm afraid of being sued. But there were only five people that had my book proposal, and only one of whom had direct access to the ISI. And one of the people that had my book proposal gave it to the ISI station chief here in D.C., Brigadier Butt. Very fortunately, he came with a nickname. Otherwise, I would have had to invent him. But yeah, Brigadier Butt is his real name. And I had a fellowship to go to Pakistan through the American Institute of Pakistan Studies the summer of 2011. And I, Ambassador Hussain Haqqani was there at the time. I had a multiple entry visa, so I was good to go. But on May 23rd, 2011, and this also followed some congressional testimony I did on LET, but I've been saying the same thing for years. I mean, there's nothing new in my position. There was nothing new, bottom line. I said the same thing about Lashkar Taiba that I'd always been saying. But I got this really creepy note towards the end of May 2011 that indicated that when I returned to Pakistan, I would be raped by a regiment, an entire regiment. And it was pretty clear based upon the language. And by the way, the ISI, when they threaten you, you're not supposed to be wondering, oh, was that the ISI? The whole point is you know that the ISI threatened you. But I'm kind of a see you next Thursday. I'm trying to keep my language clean for radio. And I said, I'm not going to be deterred. They're not really going to rape me. This is, you know, preposterous. And I had every intention of continuing on with my trip to Pakistan. In the meantime, I had a meeting with Ambassador Hussain Haqqani, and it was canceled apropos of nothing. There was no explanation. He didn't even cancel it. His assistant made it. And, of course, he and I are friends, so all of this seemed quite strange. Then I ran into another woman from the Pakistan embassy. She was a consular officer at the State Department, and she said, Christine, what have you done? Because they have circulated a notice saying that none of us are allowed to meet with you. And she said, under no uncertain terms, I have really made them angry. And I thought, well, what in the world is going on? in the meantime, I was still planning on going to Pakistan because, as I said, I am to see you next Tuesday or Thursday, depending on your preference for spelling tea. And United called me up and they said, you know, your flight to Dubai was canceled. And this was actually very fortuitous because in the time, the 24 hours that my travel was delayed, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani was finally able to get a hold of me, even though he was banned from doing so by the IFI. And he told me, you have to cancel your trip. The crew cuts are after you. And that was kind of clear that I was going to have to cancel my trip, that I was, in fact, going to be in danger if I went. And so this has been an ongoing issue. I have been blacklisted. And Ambassador Sherry was able to get me a visa to do the election monitoring mission with an organization in May of 2013. And I picked up my visa, actually, from the Defense Attaché himself. He was the one, I mean, he has been a complete pain. I mean, he is just an enemy. He, Brigadier Butt, fortunately, rotated off to Waziristan. And, you know, as they say, no good deed goes unpaid. So his successor, Brigadier Doger, was also a complete pain. If he didn't like what I said during an interview, I would get a phone call from him. I mean, just an incredibly, and I have to say, I have to remind you, I don't work for you, and I'm not working for the State Department, so I don't have to say things that are untrue to placate you. So I got my visa on a Friday. I was in Dubai on a Sunday, and I learned from the organization that sponsored me that the IFI had threatened to cancel the visa. In fact, I was told that they were canceling the visa, and I had to stay in Dubai, and I couldn't come forward, or else it would be, quote, an international crisis, international scene, or some such pointless dramatic language. The organization that sponsored me went to the interim government, and they said, look, if you cancel her visa, we're going to have to report that you manipulated with their election monitoring mission. I subsequently have learned that the organization in question had been infiltrated, and of course they were. And I never knew of where my deployment was, but it turns out the organization in question was going to send me to Sukkur in Sindh, which happens to be a new hotspot for jihadi activism. It's not really new, but Sindh is becoming increasingly known for example, Lashkar-e-Taiba activity. So I'm sure when ISI learned that I was being sent to Sukkur, they must have assumed some sort of nefarious purpose. I would have assumed that, frankly. But I had no idea where I was being deployed because they never tell you before you are to be deployed once you arrive in country, and that's for operational security reasons. So and the organization that I was with made an agreement, essentially, that I would not be deployed to Sukkur and that I would stay in the Islamabad area. It turns out Murray, the hill station, is in the Islamabad area. And so on election day, I was deployed to Murray. And what did I see? But I saw a Lashkar-e-Taiba / Jamaat-ul-Dawah recruitment facility right in front of, guess what, a military police facility. And being the see you next Thursday that I am, I took a video of this whole 360 and posted it to YouTube. And I think the snarky comment went to the effect of, I saw the thing that you didn't want me to see anyway. So I, obviously, you know, I can't get a visa to go back. I even got a Fulbright fellowship to go and teach for free in Lahore at Foreman Christian College. And I even got a second U.S. passport so that, you know, you're allowed to have a two-year passport for countries that take inordinate amounts of time to process a visa. That visa has been sitting there since February. So obviously I wasn't able to take my Fulbright. And I was the first Fulbright person to be denied a visa under this particular Fulbright program. So, yeah, they've not been very happy with me or with the book. But I really don't care, to be honest with you. We have many associates in common who think that their access to the Pakistan military and the red carpet that they get is worth their integrity. Their red carpets are soaked in American blood as far as I'm concerned, and Pakistan can take their visa and shove it up their backside, to use language that I would not ordinarily use. I would usually use more colorful language.
Don't worry about it. We can use the 7 dirty words on internet radio, so go for it. And
I'm trying to be well-behaved, John.
Oh, you're doing wonderfully. I love you. I love you unfiltered, and you're doing wonderfully for the audience here. Now, it's worth also noting that in the middle of all this, you have written this book with Oxford Press, and
yeah.
we're going to get to the story in that book here in a minute or two. But I just want to thank you very much for explaining how you go and become blacklisted, have your book banned, and be threatened, said to be sexually assaulted by a regiment.
Yeah, you know, and of course, like my response to that was, is this going to be a cavalry or an infantry regiment? Because it's going to make both a quantitative and qualitative difference in my rape experience.
Oh, God. Okay.
Am I wrong? I think they're going to be fitter. I'm not the cavalry guy sitting around in tanks having tea all day. I'm going to pass on that rape experience if I have a choice.
Oh, God.
Let's
talk
about Pakistan. Humor.
Yeah, I know. But let's talk about Pakistan.
Yes. Well, that is Pakistan. I mean, an intelligence agency that threatens an American academic with gang rape. I mean, that is Pakistan. I mean, how many countries would do that? I don't even think China would do it. China would just simply demur from giving you a visa, and they would blacklist you. How many countries would actually go to such lengths to threaten a scholar with gang rape? I mean, nothing says Pakistan more, quite frankly, than that story.
Well, just do me a favor personally. Let's not have you work on your nomination for your future Nobel Peace Prize the hard way.
Exactly. Well, I mean, look, there is another story here, which also shows you, you know, these people that want to say, you know, and they're housed in places like CFR, the New America Foundation, you know all these places where you've got these Pakistan apologists who treat them like a normal state. What would probably be useful, I think, for your listenership to know is that they have been engaging in all sorts of nefarious activity here in the States that really allies are not supposed to do. And I'm not talking about, you know, espionage like the Israelis or the French do. In New York, an ISI officer was masquerading himself as an FBI agent to harass Pakistani Americans. And we did not PNG this fellow. Actually, we just asked this fellow politely to pack up his things and go. And there wasn't any kind of fanfare, which is really quite astonishing, given the gravity of this crime. And then think about the Indian diplomat, Kabrogade, who, you know, the evidence about her, I mean, was clear that she was not a nice woman. But you compare what she did, which was basically pay an Indian citizen lousy wages that she thought she was entitled to, versus this ISI fellow who was masquerading as a Federal Bureau of Investigation officer. And I bet most of your listeners have heard of the Kabrogade affair, but they haven't heard about this ISI clown masquerading as FBI officer. They have been intimidating other Americans here. So I'm not the only one that they've been doing this to. And it's a very closely guarded secret. It was like a year and a half ago. I was even asked to testify, and I was asked to before a congressional subcommittee. And I was explicitly asked to address this issue because the other Americans that have been threatened are apparently, and I only know vague details about this, they're official Americans, and they can't testify. So while I have been... I've been very public because I'm not an official. Know that I'm not the only person that has experienced this at the hands of the intelligence agency of our alleged great ally in the war on terror, who has received about $30 billion in overt funds, and dog knows how much they've received in covert funds. I mean, this is our ally. This is what our ally does.
And let's talk about our ally, because our ally does not view itself as we, or for that matter, most of the rest of the world does. Talk about Pakistan, what it was before 47, and what it became in the decades since then.
Yeah, so, you know, I think without sounding melodramatic, the seeds of Pakistan's present were actually sowed before partition. The people who agitated for a Pakistan as the British were decolonizing the South Asian subcontinent propounded this notion called a two-nation theory. It was much more elaborate and complicated and had multiple purposes, but how Pakistanis have subsequently come to understand it, and it's a very bastardized and redacted version of this history, that the two-nation theory basically said that Muslims and Hindus were equal civilizations, even though Muslims were less numerous than Hindus. And initially, Jinnah, who became the founder of Pakistan, used this logic to argue for equal representation in the parliament of a united India for Muslims and Hindus. And the Indian National Congress said, you know, this is rubbish. And as the proponents of a Pakistan or the proponents of a two-nation theory as embodied by the Muslim League and the Indian National Congress, which wanted a secular, united India and opposed partition, as these two sides could not hatch out an agreement, they both had the mutual fear that the British would slow down the decolonization process. And essentially what the Indian National Congress said, you know what, fine, go have your flaming Pakistan, but what you're not going to extort equal representation for Muslims and Hindus in a united parliament, because that's not fair to the majority of Hindus, one man, one vote. And so Pakistan was sort of a late invention, quite frankly. And Jinnah was notoriously ill-prepared for this, to build this state, because, you know, all the evidence suggests that he didn't actually think it was going to happen. But
by the way, for those of you who saw the movie Gandhi, he's the guy with the great lighter who smoked too much.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, to be, what's interesting, Jinnah would not be welcome in today's Pakistan. He ate ham sandwiches, he drank scotch, he had Dobermans, which endears him to me. I'm a big fan of the Doberman. And most importantly, he was a Shia. So when Pakistan became independent, founded on this two-nation theory that Pakistan was the home to South Asia's Muslims, there was an immediate problem. One-fourth of Pakistan's population were not Muslims. They were, in fact, Hindus. The very population that the two-nation theory said could not live peacefully with Muslims. And this began sowing the seeds of what would become the civil war in East Pakistan, which would eventually culminate in the 71 war with India and its breakup. The next thing that Pakistan did, apart from continuing to embrace this communal ideology, is the foundation of the state. It adopted in the 50s this thing called the Objectives Resolution, which said that Pakistan was going to follow the laws of Allah. And again, this continued this process of alienating the one-fourth of the country that wasn't Muslim and contributing to the East Pakistan problem, where most of the Hindus were concentrated and who were ethnically Bengali. But this Objectives Resolution, which became part of the Constitution, created a permanent role for religious leaders to say who is Muslim enough. And it began with attacking the Ahmadis, who are now hunted viciously. It's like open season on Ahmadis. People in Pakistan consider killing the Ahmadis to be appropriate Quranically, because they're considered to be apostates. The expression used is wajibul qatl, which means suitable for murder, suitable for death. Then they began coming after the Shia, that many in Pakistan do not believe to be proper Muslims, and you can track the Shia killing that has just been rampant. And now even the militants are going after the so-called Barelvis, the Sufis, who are believed to be a majority of Pakistan. So in some sense, this trajectory of internal instability due to Islamist terrorism, I think, can be traced back to the very founding non-democratic and communitarian nature of the state's founding ideology, the two-nation theory.
And it is your contention that, and I have been one of them at various times in my life, who think that Pakistan if we just give them time, they'll grow up, mature, and become a stable security state. You contend, on the contrary, and with more and more evidence to support your position, that they are, in fact, an ideological state. Explain that to our listeners, what the difference is.
Yeah, so to first unpack the first part of your question, Americans, and I think also British, have treated Pakistan like a state that engages in reckless policies because it feels insecure, that there's this big neighbor to the east, India. It's always been bigger. It actually was the beneficiary of the partition process. Pakistan got the short end of the stick in partition. There had never been a history of governing Pakistan from the capital, which was first Karachi and then later Islamabad. All of the government ministries had to be built from scratch, and there was inadequate personnel to do this. This was also part of the state's choice that Urdu become the national language, because there were very few Urdu speakers, all of whom came from India. And this shut out the bureaucratic expertise in East Pakistan, because none of them knew Urdu. They were Bengali speakers. So part of their shortage of personnel was a choice about language, when the majority of the people were actually Bengali and speaking Bengali. So they chose this language that no one spoke. But nonetheless, they had to rebuild the state from scratch. And then on top of that, after 1971, when India intervened in the civil war and broke up the country, people sort of view Pakistan as, the state that's got real security issues. And if we can do something to make Pakistan secure, it will behave differently. So in other words, we can transform Pakistan through F-16s, through a big foreign military financing program, an economic support program, military training, and essentially all the stuff that we've done with Pakistan has basically been to make it feel more secure so that it can put down the jihadi assets, normalize its relations with India, and by extension, stop seeking strategic depth in Afghanistan. I argue that this is actually a grotesque misreading of Pakistan, what it does and why it does it. I go through 6 decades of their defense publications. So these are things that they write for themselves, amongst themselves. They were not intended for me, you, or any non-Pakistani to see, but I'm tenacious and was able to collect these publications systematically. And I argue that it does what it does, not for security, but it does it for ideology. So, for example, Pakistan's claim on Indian-administered Kashmir, there is no legal basis for this claim. India has an instrument of accession. When, in 1947, tribal marauders from Pakistan, with various levels of provincial and federal support, invaded Kashmir to seize it for Pakistan, and India subsequently airlifted troops to Kashmir, it only did so after the sovereign of Kashmir signed an instrument of accession. So it was protecting, essentially, its own territory at that point. There's no legal claim for Kashmir. Yet Pakistan continues to act as if it does. Now, you could make the argument that this is all about water security, right? That South Asia has a water scarcity issue, and all of the countries of South Asia, particularly India and Pakistan, get water from the Indus, which is in Kashmir. You could make a water security argument. You could make an argument that you should order the line of control to make changes along the ridgeline, because, you're looking at some altitudes 15,000 feet and above that would make them more defensible to both sides. You can make any number of security arguments about changing the territorial status quo. But in 6 decades of their literature, none of the pieces that I came across ever made that argument. Instead, his arguments about Pakistan needs to have Kashmir, because without Kashmir, the two-nation theory remains unfructified. How can Pakistan be the homeland of South Asia's Muslims, yet it doesn't have Kashmir? It, in other words, it's making an ideological claim to this territory, not a security or even a strategic claim. And similarly, when it talks about its relationship with India, and this is where some of what Pakistan does could be explained by security if you believed Pakistan's rhetoric, namely that India is implacably opposed to Pakistan's existence. But, of course, that's just not the case. Pakistan, in fact, has to create this civilizational conflict with India because civilizational conflicts cannot be resolved. So if you look at statements of various army chiefs, they have said that peace with India requires India to accept the two-nation theory and to accept Pakistan as its equal. And, in fact, these claims are more or less coterminous because the two-nation theory, of course, originally meant that the nation of Muslims was equivalent to or as great as or as important as the nation of Hindus. And so India's acceptance of the two-nation theory would imply that it accepts Pakistan as a co-equal. And obviously, India is not going to make this concession ever because India rejects the two-nation theory. If India were to accept the two-nation theory, how would it then accommodate the numbers are not even, they're debatable. But India is well known as the largest Muslim minority in the world, in addition to many other non-Hindus. And so it can't accept the two-nation theory. And of course it's not going to accept Pakistan as an equal. So the Pakistan Army, in its literature, has defined its conflict with India not in security terms, but rather in very clearly ideological terms. And what I argue in the book, drawing from the work of Charlie Glaser, who actually coined this way of thinking about revisionism and why some states are revisionist and why other states are not, if you treat a security-seeking, if you treat an ideological state like a security-seeking state, you incentivize all of the bad behaviors. And I argue in the book that that's exactly what we've done. U.S. foreign policy, by completely misunderstanding what Pakistan does and why it does it, in doing so, we have incentivized all of the things that undermine our interest. Most perniciously, the most important tool that Pakistan's military has developed to prosecute its ideological agenda with India is jihad under its expanding nuclear umbrella. So we have aided and we have abetted this very directly through our misunderstanding of what Pakistan does and why.
We're going to take a quick break and run some network messages, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the actual subject of your book, the Pakistani Army and its place within Pakistani society. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to Right Stream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Diane.
And this is Denise.
And we want to invite you to listen to the History Goes Bump podcast.
Ghost tours for the theater of the mind.
The History Goes Bump podcast. A show featuring a look at historic locations, people, and events with a twist. This history podcast is haunted. So grab your slippers, hot chocolate, flashlight, and maybe even that baseball bat, and join us.
You can find the show at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other various podcast catchers.
Check out the website at historygoesbump.com.
Keep it spooky.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. And so we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we're back. This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham. And today we're talking to Professor Christine Fair from Georgetown University about the Pakistani Army and her new book, Fighting to the End. Are you still with us there, Christine?
I am. Thank you.
Now, you just talked about your perceptions, your interpretations of what kind of a state. Well, I'm not even sure we can use the word country or republic, but what kind of a state Pakistan is. And you contend, obviously, that it is an ideological state as opposed to a national security state, or something that would be recognizable by most Western observers. As you go through this book that you've written, you make the case that the fundamental central governing authority within Pakistan is not the parliament. It is not even the government. It is, in fact, the Pakistani army and the various components of that army within. Talk about why you believe that and what. How, make your case.
Well, I mean, it's actually, this is probably the least controversial part of the book. So for a number of reasons, so going back, as I said, to partition, India retained all of the central bureaucracies of the Raj, the Indian Administrative Service, all of the training facilities that produce bureaucrats. The parts that became India had actually been under British domination for much longer, in some sense, in some cases, a difference of over more than 200 years. And this meant that the processes of indigenous governance were much more rooted in the parts that became India. In contrast, the part that became today's Pakistan were frequently in a more militarized form of colonial administration. So the Northwest Frontier Province, so for example, was named because it was the Northwest Frontier Province of the Raj. And much of the Pakistani territory was actually envisioned as an internal buffer separating the heart of the Raj, which is basically defined as everything east of the Indus, from Afghanistan, which was the ultimate buffer separating the frontiers of the Russian Empire with that of the British Empire. So you had significantly less experience with, for example, provincial assemblies in the places that became today's Pakistan than what became India. And as I said, all of these ministries had to be created from scratch. India did not have this problem. And Pakistan was also more greatly affected by the human costs of partition, as now, even though about one-third of South Asia's Muslims stayed in what became India, you had a large exodus of people who were Muslim going from India to Pakistan. And as a percentage of the population transfer, a percentage of the population transfer compared to the population that was there to begin with, Pakistan was much more affected. And essentially, while the military itself was also shambolic compared to the Indian army, it was still the strongest of all of the capabilities that the state acquired. And as the Pakistani state continued to evolve, the hegemony of the army expanded. So one of the very first things that happened in Pakistan's history is that you had your first military coup in the late 80s by Ayub Khan. And this was not a coincidence. And as Ayub Khan expanded, General Ayub Khan, who then also made himself president, expanded his presence, he made sure to debilitate and eviscerate any of Pakistan's nation democratic institutions. He had this idea of basic democracies, which was really about creating an alternative patronage base that would basically dislocate political fealties from political parties to the army. And so you have this process whereby the Pakistan Army from day one was the most present institution. Relative to India, it was, as I said, still shambolic, but relative to all the other institutions, it was the strongest, most capable, and it was least personnel constrained compared to the other organizations. And once the army was rooted in power, it continued to expand its presence. And of course, the longer the military stays in power, the less practiced Pakistan's democratic institutions become, so that when the military does finally retreat back to its barracks, they are less democratic in their quality, in their institutions, and in their nature than they were before the military intervened. So Pakistan is a story of the military being the strongest from day one, but taking advantage of its preeminent position from day one to really create a massive imbalance. Central to this is also the Pakistan military's persistent narrative that the civilians are incompetent buffoons. I cannot emphasize enough how often military personnel deride the civilians as corrupt bastards. And if you say it enough, people begin to believe it. And of course, Pakistan's military shields itself from any questions about its own corrupt nature because it makes data about it impossible to obtain. So in doing so, if you look at the portfolio of things that the United States cares most about, that's going to be relations with the United States, Afghanistan, China, Saudi Arabia, India, security policy, defense policy, the army doesn't even consult the prime minister, much less the National Assembly and the Senate. So this means that what the politicians do have control over are those things that don't directly affect the military. So, but even on those issues, you'd be surprised how even domestic issues like education affects the military. It affects the military in a couple of ways. One, you do have an education requirement to get into the Pakistan Military Academy and also to join either as a Jawan. But you also want to make sure that Pakistan's textbooks are propounding an ideology that is consonant with that of the Army's preferences. So the very first Army chief, Ayub Khan, actually declared that Pakistan's military not only defends the territorial integrity of the state, but also the ideological integrity of the state. And so Ayub Khan, for example, made sure that Pakistan's curriculum, the textbooks, and the school curriculum aligned with this ideology. So it's actually under Ayub Khan that some of this crazy stuff was introduced about if you were to read Pakistani textbooks, basically Pakistan's origins the beginning of Pakistan is coterminous with the arrival of Islam, for example, in South Asia. Very derogatory descriptions of Hindus, compressing the treatment of the different Hindu empires before Islam arrived, as well as very problematic notions of the state's own history. So Pakistanis learned that India started every war and that Pakistan won every one of them except for the 71 war. So even on issues that you would think would be not of interest to the Pak military, like education, it's very much in their interest. So this means that Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif right now, when he came in, he obviously hated the army. He was ousted by President Musharraf in a coup in 1999. He really ran on a platform of putting the army back to its barracks, asserting civilian control over key foreign and defense policy matters. And the army has not dealt a nice hand to Nawaz Sharif. You know, the army's behind all of this nonsense with Imran Khan and the cleric in effort to weaken him. So it's by a long-winded way of saying, Pakistan's never, with the exception of one period in time, and that was between 71 and 77, when Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was basically the civilian autocrat, Pakistan's never been run by the civilians. It's always been run by the generals and their confederates and the bureaucracy.
Now, let's make it clear, because you have gone and also contended that the Pakistani military is not like ours. We have relative parity in budget and authority here in the United States military. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the vice chairman, for example, rotate depending upon who the civilian leadership wants to have as their military deputy. The Navy and the Air Force in Pakistan don't have any standing under, as you would say, compared to the Army. And you said something particularly mean about how the Army views the Navy, and I'd like you to say that again, if you don't mind.
Well, actually, I mean, I'm just repeating what I've heard, that the Navy is the fourth of three services. So the Navy War College is in Lahore, which is a very long distance away from anything like an ocean, and unless you count the fetid sewers that run open in Lahore to count as a body of water. So, the Army basically runs the show. There's, you know, you've never, the idea that an air chief would have a coup and the air chief would be the president, it's really humorous that you can't even say it without smirking, because it's just so preposterous.
This is not America, where Air Force colonels go have coups. This is an Army operation.
Yeah, this is very much an Army operation. I mean, it's an interesting question, what it means to be members of the other services. But this does have very direct security. So I want to talk about the position of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So whereas in our system, that is a very important post. In Pakistan, that's a symbolic post. So when some corps commanders do not please the Army chief, but the Army chief doesn't want to deny him a promotion because that would be seen as unseemly and would cause unpleasant unpleasant attitudes amongst the Corps commanders, what they'll do is they'll park that dude in the position of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And that's basically because he's not in command of any troops, and he's not in a position of power. So it's basically like putting the problem child in a well-decorated corner. So everyone understands that.
Like we would with the vice president, whose position has been described many times as not worth a bucket of warm spit.
Yeah, pretty much. And so so when people get promoted to that particular position, it's sort of like a it's just sort of like a flaccid handshake, because your options were just not get promoted at all, which basically means go into retirement, or take this position that everyone understands is just a pain in the butt. That's where they put people who have no utility, but it's where they can kind of keep them out of trouble, but without causing any turbulence or minimal turbulence within the Corps commander. So unlike our system, where that's a very important position, in Pakistan that's not important at all, for all intents and purposes. What really matters is the Army chief as well as his Corps commanders. Now, this has really interesting security implications that Pakistanis understand. I mean, Pakistani security analysts understand, but I'm not sure that they know how to fix the problem. So because the Army will be most likely involved in coup making, the Army, particularly when they get promoted beyond the ranks of majors, and if you get selected to go to the Command and Staff College in Quetta as a major, you also go through this vetting process because you're going to be interacting with foreigners. But they begin going through this very elaborate security vetting. And that's because, you know, the Pakistan Army understands that it has an insider threat. It always has had a potential insider threat. So unlike Bangladesh, where you have coups within coups, coups in Pakistan are generally speaking very well-ordered affairs. You don't have an immediate coup after the first coup. And Bangladesh has, you know, the first coup Bangladesh had was like a coup zoo. It wasn't really clear who was going to come out on top until you had someone out on top. Pakistan's not like that. It all clearly follows the lead of the Army chief. Now, what this does mean, because no one ever assumes that you're ever going to have a coup in the Navy, which is, again, just really silly. I can't even say it without sniggering, or the Air Force, equally preposterous. They do not have the same rigorous security checks as the Army does. And so if you look at some of the most outrageous instances of infiltration and security breach, it's actually involved relatively low-ranking members of these other services. So in the Musharraf assassination attempts, you actually had Air Force civilian personnel as well as Air Force armed uniformed personnel. Take a look at the Mehran attack right after the Osama bin Laden raid, and that was on a very important naval facility in Karachi that showed a large degree of naval infiltration. In September, al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent's maiden launch, the militants were supposed to seize a Pakistani frigate, then rendezvous with U.S. ships on counterterrorism patrols, and then they were going to fire upon the U.S. ships using the onboard weapon systems. Fortunately, a keen gunner noted that the fellows that were – so basically the first tranche of terrorists came in because they had naval – they had Navy uniforms, and they were actually naval personnel. The next tranche of terrorists, they were dressed as Marines, and they were going to join the frigate on a smaller craft. And as they approached the frigate – the gunner noticed that while they were wearing proper uniforms, they did not have standard issue weapons. They were using AKs, and that was not the standard weapon. And so then the gunner fired a warning shot onto this incoming vehicle, this incoming vessel, and then they assumed that the war was on, and then that whole thing played out. But the point of this is that these other security forces have an infiltration problem. And that's because they basically were viewed as the little kids at the table, and they weren't taken seriously. Then with respect to the Army itself, you'll see many of these important attacks, like the attack in 2007 at the Special Services Group, which is like their commando's headquarters at Tarbela. Basically, military, you know, army guys at the rank of major were very critical at facilitating those kinds of attacks. So this perception of big bad army running the show and being most important has had significant security impacts for Pakistan. And I don't think, while they might have an appreciation of the problem, I don't think they know how to fix this problem.
And there's a certain inertia because they've acquired a lot of very important pieces that are part of the national security construct for Pakistan. And I would point out, too, that my listeners I know are interested in. One, they have control of the nuclear forces, and you can explain a little bit about how they have that. And at the same time, they also encompassed that shadowy organization we hear the name of so much, and you've used a couple of times, the ISI, their intelligence apparatus. Talk a little bit about those two details as part of, again, this vast, vast construct that is the Pakistani army.
Yeah, so, you know, I think when Americans think about the Cold War and our nuclear Cold Warriors, I think everyone sort of thought of, like, Strategic Air Command flying a payload over to Russia in what was essentially a one-way mission, right? That was going to be a suicide bombing mission. There's no way. We didn't have aero refuelers. They were going to have to drop their ordnance, and that was going to be the end of them. And then we, certainly by the time we got to the 80s, I know when I was a kid growing up in the Cold War, then you always thought about the different missile silos. So, you know, you have to think about what the Pakistan nuclear public imaginary is. And in the public imaginary and in reality, this is very much an army-controlled show. Now, what's interesting about the nuclear program is that they didn't start it. Actually, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was the proponent of it. Ayub Khan derided his insistence that Pakistan develop its own nuclear capability, and he began making this argument around 64, 65, and his logic was India was defeated by China in 62. China tested at Lop Nur in 1964, and that was, of course, how it became one of the permanent members of the Security Council and a permanent nuclear weapon state under the NPT. And then in the 65 war, neither China nor the United States helped Pakistan. So Zulfikar concluded that it had to have its own nuclear weapons program. And most importantly, he concluded that India was going to weaponize because of its defeat in 62 with China and China's test in 64. And Ayub Khan, in 65, said to Zulfikar, if we need a nuclear weapon, we'll get it from the Americans. We'll just get one off the shelf. And then after the 71 war, when the military was licking its wounds, Zulfikar came to power and he pioneered this program. And then the army snatched it from him when Zia waged his coup in 77, and it's remained with the army ever since. And that's just the way it is. Pakistan, the missiles that would deliver the program are an army asset. They do have, of course, Air Force assets that can deliver the weapons if need be, an F-16 or a Mirage. But the physical protection of the assets come under the Strategic Plans Directorate. And General Kidwai himself, a retired Army general. So this is very much an Army enterprise. The ISI, I get very frustrated when people describe the ISI as rogue. It turns out Ambassador Oakley, who was an American ambassador in the 80s to Pakistan, coined this notion of a rogue ISI. And the reason why he coined it was that Congress was getting very frustrated with Pakistan's duplicity as our partner. And yet, during the 80s, we were still very much of the belief that we had to keep working with them because of the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan. So actually, our own ambassador coined this idea, and actually he told me this. So this isn't even hearsay. He actually told me this over lunch one day. He coined this expression so that he could explain Pakistan's duplicitous behavior, when in fact there was no explanation other than duplicity. So ironically, we introduced this notion of the rogue ISI narrative so that we could explain why Pakistan was was doing one thing to help us while undermining us elsewhere. The ISI is not rogue. Its director general comes from the Army. The Army seconds Army officers to the ISI. Their home organization is the Army. If they disregard instructions, their career in the Army is jeopardized. You do have some people who get marooned in the ISI. They get passed over for promotion, and they basically stay there. They also have civilians, just like we do. And they also have a whole flotilla of contractors, just like we do, that enhance their plausible deniability. So the ISI, you know, operates in many of the same ways like the CIA does or any other big intelligence organization that engages in covert operations, but there are some also really important distinctions. Unlike the CIA, the ISI also has a huge mandate domestically. So going back to the whole thing about making sure that the civilians look stupid and the Army looks great, the ISI orchestrates protests against civilians. It rigs elections. General Asad Durrani came clean. I don't know why his conscience all of a sudden started bothering him, but about 3 years ago, he testified before the Pakistani Supreme Court about how when he was DG ISI, he was in charge of an election rigging campaign that involved moving millions of dollars around to different candidates. They help assemble coalitions of the willing. They do everything from rig elections to helping different political coalitions work to make sure that some political officials leave one party and defect to another. So, for example, Imran Khan's PTI experienced a bunch of defections from major parties, so much so that the Pakistanis called it the Pakistani turncoat industry. And the speculation was that these turncoats were facilitated by ISI lubrication. It differs from the CIA in another important way, and that is the oversight. So at the end of the day, accountability with the U.S. CIA rests with Congress, and who are obviously elected representatives of the United States citizenry, and there are oversight committees in both the House and the Senate, and there are also specialized committees where people have appropriate clearances to oversee nuanced and specialized aspects of what the CIA does. So, for example, the drone program. And so at the end of the day, the CIA...
A very involved democratic process for keeping an eye on the clandestine service.
Yeah. Now, does it work perfectly? No, it does not. And when it doesn't work perfectly, you have congressional commissions, heads roll, people go to jail. And so there's people in the CIA know that so in the worst-case scenario, I go to jail. And so even if they're told to do something that they believe to be illegal, there's this, you know, this wrangling within the organization that there's going to be multiple lawyer reviews. But everyone operates with the assumption that if they violate the law, they will go to jail. Now, yeah, there's some cowboys out there who could give a crap. And we saw that, like, the Iran-Contra scandal. And there were prosecutions, and, of course, there were presidential pardons as well. In Pakistan, there's no civilian oversight. Constitutionally, there's supposed to be, but the Constitution is honored in its breach, not in its in its execution. So basically, unlike the CIA, the ISI operates under the whim of the Army. So whether Pakistani citizens like the idea that their country uses a large percentage of their resources to sponsor insurgent activities in Afghanistan and terrorism in Afghanistan as well as India, it doesn't matter what they think, because there's no mechanism for civilian oversight over the ISI. And that is a huge difference between the two organizations, in addition to the fact that the ISI has an enormous domestic role as well.
And to quote a great line from Casablanca, I'm shocked to hear there's gambling in this establishment.
Also prostitution, wife swapping, boozing, key parties in the cantonments. The book I really want to write is called 50 Shades of Cocky.
Oh, my goodness. That, you know, you might want to hold off on that one, because in case you haven't noticed, and this is worth noting, the initial reaction to this book not only included being banned by the Pakistani Army, not by the government, but by the Army, and they actually...
For the ISI.
And they made YouTube videos denouncing you.
But yeah, they were quite comical. I mean, they haven't exactly gone viral, and I have my own soundtrack, which is really lovely. And the pictures that they selected were flattering. They could have picked less flattering pictures from the intertubes. And then the best part about it was Oxford University Press, when they brought out their version in Pakistan, I was told very explicitly that they would not be using the cover because the cover offended the army. And I was like, you gotta be kidding. A book cover can't offend the goddamn army. It was really spectacular. And so the cover, the version that is suitable for all of South Asia except Pakistan, it actually says, the version that you get in India and elsewhere says, suitable for all countries in South Asia except Pakistan. And then I've also heard, I haven't gotten official confirmation that they're thinking about banning the book. I heard from someone who bought the book in Karachi that the bookseller said, Jaldi, Jaldi, Khareed Lo, ban Ho Jaga, you know, quickly buy this book, it's about to be banned. But whether or not the ban has taken place, I don't know. And then my favorite, and of course you never know the official imprimatur of this, on Tuesday I received a charming email where the sender was in Chinese characters, which is not a surprise actually, because that's what the Pakistan's best friends of the Chinese. They assembled an image of an AK-47 using the winged bat, the characters in the winged bat font. It was a very well done AK-47, I may add, and it said, it was pointing at this phrase that says "loving you." So, you know, lots of love coming in from the Al Pakistanis. But I'm a crafty old witch. I will not be deterred.
I wouldn't expect you to be, but I will ask. I will ask you to consider something in a Kevlar raincoat for the winter, please.
Oh, I have my Kevlar bustier. It's all ready to go.
We've got about 10 minutes left that we can talk, and I'd like to finish this up by talking about, you know, we have a couple of phrases that you and I and other people in our business talk about. We talk about 21st century first world problems. Well, if you're in the Pakistani army and you're at the top leadership, are your problems, how are you going to deal with this reality that's been built, or, you know, since 1947, and how do you go forward?
Well, okay, so this is actually, I mean, this is the thing that is confronting them today, namely that because of 9/11 and the decision of Musharraf to cooperate with us in the war on Al-Qaeda, and to be fair, I mean, we could not have done what we did in Afghanistan without Pakistan's early cooperation. It's just that they did a U-turn on their U-turn subsequent to that. But because of that, many of Pakistan's erstwhile proxies that they had been nurturing and raising for decades began turning their suicide belts, their vehicle-borne IEDs, guns and grenades against the state itself. And this is what has eventually given rise to the what's called the TPP, the Tehrik-e-Taliban-e-Pakistan, or the Pakistani Taliban. And that the Pakistani Taliban, it's not really a coherent organization like the name suggests. It's not like the Afghan Taliban, which is much more coherent, even though you do have obviously differences within that organization. But the TTP really is an anti-Pakistan organization. But there would be no TTP or Pakistani Taliban if there had been no Afghan Taliban, if there had been no Jaish-e-Mohammed, had there been no Harkat-ul-Jihad Islami, and so forth. And so the Pakistan military is you know, it sits here at a conundrum. It also has increased infiltration within its ranks. And in part, you know, this is because it has both propounded a jihadist ideology in their writings. I detail this at length in my book. But it also then co-located elements of the force structure with actual jihadists. So what does it do? So I would argue that the only way that Pakistan can genuinely defeat this Islamist terrorism menace, and it is menacing, although I might add that the number that they typically tout out, the magical climbing number of 50,000, 60,000, I mean, the number changes every week, that number can't be replicated. We find when we use independent databases, it's a far fewer number, maybe 16,000 Pakistanis versus 50,000. Anywhere, the number is probably in between, and it's a lot of Pakistanis who are dying. But the only way Pakistan can really get ahead of this is if it strategically abandons terrorism under its nuclear umbrella as a tool of foreign policy, which it has no intention of doing. So let's take a look at the operations that, and this is why they were very angry at me in one of the videos. They were very upset about my characterization of Zarb-e-Azab there, which means the sword of the prophet, the operation that they're conducting in Waziristan. I've been very cynical of this because they gave the terrorists 5 months warning. No, we're coming. No, we really are coming. If you haven't left yet, know that we're coming. And why did they give them 5 months warning? Well, the reason for that is simple. They were trying to split the TTP's leadership and cadre into those that would be willing to go kill Afghans and Americans and our allies in Afghanistan, and also those that would be willing to go and rejoin their constituent terrorist organizations for operations in India. And, you know, you'll note right now all the shelling that was going on. It's died down, but the shelling was very intense. And the one of the posited reasons for this is so they could infiltrate some of these terrorists into India before the snows come. So the terrorists that remained in Waziristan were those terrorists that could not be flipped and remain dedicated foes of the Pakistani state. Is Pakistan killing them? Yes, it's doing so with great cost, a lot of civilian displacement, and a lot of damage, unlike the drones, which are very surgical. You don't have enormous IDP populations resulting from drones like you do from Pakistani military operations, which involve heavy use of conventional forces, artillery, F-16s, attack helicopters. A former Pakistani air chief even has gone on record saying that Pakistan has used AC-130s in their own domestic operations. So they fight their domestic foe conventionally while fighting their conventional foe India asymmetrically, which is kind of puzzling. So they have this problem, and they know it, but until they decide to get rid of jihad as a strategy, it's not going to go away. There are a couple other countervailing issues that are kind of interesting. One, most of the Pakistani units are experiencing their first casualties, not from Indians, but by Pakistanis. That has to have a long-term effect that's important. And then they're also changing their recruitment base to get more Sindhis and Baloch who don't share the worldview of the Punjabis and the Pashtuns. So, you know, if you sort of think about what the army is going to look like 20 years from now, there's a lot of unknowns because each of these factors could have either a tempering effect or an exacerbating effect, depending on which factors trump over time.
And you made the point during our discussion that the army chiefs have a demographic problem to deal with as well, because over half of the country's population is under 21. They're young. They have extremely high unemployment. They are underskilled. And what are you going to do with them?
Well, that's the perennial problem. But basically, the Pakistan Army strategy is to rent its strategic utility out in exchange for bilateral and multilateral payouts, and that's what they've always done. Pakistan's always been an economic crisis, but the world's always too afraid of Pakistan failing. So the IMF is always there to write out a loan program, knowing full well that Pakistan will retrench from any of its various commitments, and it will open a new program without making Pakistan make do even modestly on any of its previous commitments under previous IMF programs. And Pakistan can always be assured these bailouts to deal with its economic problems so that the army never has to confront budgetary restrictions by relying upon this idea that it's too dangerous to fail, and the international community will just keep writing checks. So that's going back to like my opening remarks. Like, we've enabled all of this. Our aid program may have been well intentioned, but we've actually incentivized the worst things that the Pakistan Army has chosen to do and has been allowed to do because of our economic policies and our other ways of engaging the state.
Last question. And this is where I ask you to go and be that mystic witch you were talking about earlier and dust off your crystal ball. What do you see as the probable outcome in the next 10 to 20 years and this generation in Pakistan? Is it going to be mushroom clouds? Is it going to be more of the same? Is it going to be a festering hellhole or some combination of all?
Well, it's going to be a festering hellhole. Pakistan, for better or for worse, is not a failing state. It's not a failed state. It is a state. It's kind of like the Bondo-mobile going down the Autobahn of international relations. It just keeps keeping on. It has a resilience that I think is understudied and misunderstood. So I don't see the place. It's not going to spin away. It's not going to break up in the Indian fantasy, as some Indian hawks fantasize. But the resilience that kind of keeps the place afloat is also the very thing that makes it very difficult to make meaningful reforms. So what I do see happening is that the sectarianism that right now focuses on Shia and Sunni, this is going to give way to a much larger sectarian conflict in Pakistan about who is the correct Muslim. The particular sectarian tradition that dominates these militant groups are the Deobandis. Even though they're not a majority in Pakistan, they think they should be. They're going after, as I said, Shia, Ahmadis, and Barelvis, who are the majority. So I see Pakistan being an increasingly more dangerous place. The politicians, unless they sort of get their shit together and learn to legislate on things that matter, it's going to be unable to just sort of stem this persistent, hellhole that Pakistan is becoming. So to give you sort of an example of the structural issues, so they don't have proper legal frameworks to prosecute terrorists. That's by design because no one really wants to get involved in this. But they are passing laws that criminalize cannibalism because they did have two cannibals, and they realized that they had inadequate laws to prosecute the two cannibals. Okay.
Cannibals?
Cannibals. They had two cannibals. They were brothers. They dug up corpses. They first raped the corpses, had sex with the corpses, and then consumed them. But the parliament is on it. The parliament is crafting laws that criminalize. Now, you would imagine that improper disposal of a biohazard. Anyways, they're on it. They're on it. They're criminalizing cannibalism. Now, let's look at the police. The police are incapable of assembling what's called an FIR report, which is basically the criminal charge sheet. They have forensic capabilities that can discern whether the blood is that of a human or a cat, but they can't do ballistics. They obviously can't do DNA. You therefore have, when these cases get to the judges themselves are scared shitless to prosecute because they have no personal security and they make no money. The only way they make money is through bribery because of purchasing power parity. They made more money during the Raj than they do today. And so none of these terrorists ever get actually prosecuted. And Tahir Qadri, who killed Salman Taseer, the Punjab governor, because Qadri said that Taseer was a blasphemer because he had the audacity to say that the blasphemy law is a bad law, he admitted to his crime, and therefore the judge had to convict him, and he had to leave the country under death threats. So you just look at any feature of Pakistan's internal security and law and order problem, and you see that there's neither political will nor political capability to attenuate these challenges. Having said that, like I said, it's a very resilient place. It's not just going to crumble. It's not going to go up in a blaze of a mushroom cloud. It's just going to become a place that's increasingly horrible for Pakistanis. And unfortunately, what happens in Pakistan doesn't stay in Pakistan. So it's also going to be a place that presents ever more security challenges to its neighbors. And every once in a while, we're going to have to deal with the terrorism problem that Pakistan cultivates deliberately.
We've got about 30 seconds left before we're going to run out of bandwidth here. I want to say thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. And I hope that when you get your next book done, you'll come on again and give us a little taste of yourself again, because it's
all right.
Refreshing.
Well, thank
and
you.
Wonderful.
This has been so fun. Thank you so much.
And you and I will talk again soon. Take care.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
And with that, we will go and move on. We will be back next week with, hopefully, a stealth fighter pilot who has written a great book for our friends at Zenith Press. Until then, we will talk to you again on Military Monday. Thank you.